Maybe that's going to be the running theme, is every movie we review has to have a nude swimming scene in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK, and welcome to another of our TMR movie roundtable discussions, in which we are discussing movies that connect in some way or other with themes explored on TMR over the last 7 or 8 years. Earlier this year, we started out with the 1970 conspiracy movie Brotherhood of the Bell, starring Glenn Ford. Then we progressed on to Batman the Movie from 1966, starring the one and only Adam West, which was a particularly revelatory episode, I think, and which Frank Johnson is hoping we're going to continue, but we're not, followed by 12 Monkeys from 1995, and last time The Illustrated Man from 69, starring Rod Steiger and Claire Bloom. And today, for number 5 in this series, we're going to be chatting about the environmentalist post-apocalyptic science fiction film from 1972 called Silent Running, starring Bruce Dern, for which we welcome back our good friends and good movie enthusiasts Frank Johnson and Mark Campbell. Gentlemen, welcome back to the TMR Movie Roundtable.
Thanks for having me, Julian. Thank you.
Thanks, Julian, and I'm super eager to start talking about Batman.
Sorry to disappoint you, Frank, but I think we have done that one. We've definitely done that one. Yes. Okay, well, Frank, can we start with you? How are things going for you over there in the sunny United States, sunny California?
It's hot, a little bit humid, but not as humid as my previous state of residence, Minnesota. There's some wildfires going on up north because it's, I guess, also fire season here, so that's making things a little hazy here and there, but overall things are okay. We're still under lockdown. Our governor sort of still has us on lockdown and mask requirements and stuff, and everybody inconsistently enforces the opening or closing, so it's really kind of humorous in a way.
Yeah, and what about the political situation over there? Is there lots of rioting and the like?
That's almost like a whole other episode, I think, like a whole
Okay, yeah.
It is getting interesting. I won't talk too much about it, but the Democratic Party put up Joe Biden.
Sure.
He seems to be having some sort of mental competence issues or something, like perhaps he's got like dementia or something. I don't know. He seems to. And he's saying a lot of like weird stuff, you know. Uh-huh. If this was like Trump running, like they would have laughed him out by now, you know. And his running mate, Kamala Harris, like the African-American community here, they hate this woman because she locked up a bunch of people for like really minor, you know, like marijuana charges or whatever. So you got that. And then you got the other side who just hates Donald Trump just for being Donald Trump. So the political situation here is interesting. It's going to get more interesting. There's been almost 90 days of riots in Portland, Oregon. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and I've seen many, many of these memes on Facebook implying that he is losing his marbles, and I just wondered whether there was any truth to it at all, or whether it was just poking fun at him.
It's either true, and he's got some sort of issues, or he's faking it so he doesn't have to be responsible for any Ukraine scandals he may or may not be part of. All this to say that I think Her Majesty will probably be just watching this with some whatever she eats when she's watching entertainment.
Her Majesty the Queen.
Yes, yeah, so she's probably like, oh, those colonials. Yeah.
Pot noodle, I think.
Yeah.
She's waiting for you all to return to your true nationhood.
Yeah. It's like any day now, any day now.
Mark, how are things in London? Is it as it was last time, or have things changed much?
Well, quite similar to what Frank said, actually. We're not in lockdown, so it's sort of back to normal, but not. I mean, I work in central London, and it's still very empty because there are no tourists. Very few office workers have returned to work. They're working either at home or they're furloughed. A lot of restaurants and pubs are still closed and shops are closed, some for good, some just temporarily. Yeah. Some places like trains are very quiet. Cinemas are open now. Theatres aren't open, but cinemas are, which seems, again, slightly odd. I think you can have weddings with up to 30 people at the reception. So obviously from more than two households. Other times, there are lifts at London Bridge Station one of the biggest stations in London, and the lifts there, you're only allowed two people or people from the same household, not more than one household in the lift, and it's a massive lift at any one time. Whereas other times you go past a pub and there are people, lots of people hanging out at the pub. So it's all very, very inconsistent, which is kind of what Frank was saying, I think.
Now, I'm beginning to wonder whether that's the point.
Well,
of it being inconsistent, keeping everybody in a state of confusion is actually desired to some extent. I don't know. That's me being very cynical.
Well, but,
everything seems so crazy at the moment. I'm beginning to wonder.
No, I think you're right. I mean, so essentially anybody can sort of say anything and be believed. You know, shops, you are supposed to wear a mask in shops, but the people who work in the shops don't have to wear masks. There are lots of reasons why you don't need to wear masks, anxiety, heart condition, but, you know, you don't have to prove it. I mean, I work in the shop and most of the people who come in are elderly, and I say to them, well, do you have a mask? They don't come in with a mask. Do you have a mask? Oh yes, I've got a mask here somewhere. So they put it on. And other people, well, you know, I just ask very politely, and oh no, I'm not allowed to wear one. Okay, well, that's fine.
Yes,
it's just very odd. I suppose the point is to keep it down, and you can't have 100%, but just this helps, I suppose, is the thinking behind it.
There's a huge debate about that, isn't it? The thing that I find remarkable is that the number of people who are wearing masks completely unnecessarily outside.
Yes.
And, of course, on their own in a car.
Oh, I mean, it's hilarious. I see that. Driving along on their own in a car.
Well, it's hilarious, but also a bit disturbing as well.
I had a meme the other day. I said, right now, somewhere, somebody is taking a shower with a mask on.
Yes, it wouldn't surprise me if that's true.
Well, I've gone swimming a few times now with my little 11-month-old boy, and I was tempted to wear a mask in the pool just to be sort of performance art.
You should do it, definitely.
Couldn't be bothered.
Okay, well, I suppose we better talk about this, Phil.
Oh, yeah.
So, Silent Running here, 1972. So, I mean, what we did last time was to give our sort of brief impressions about this film before we get into any detail. I've got a little, well, I say a little plot summary here, but actually it's quite an extensive one as usual. Anyway, before I get on to that, perhaps we should just give these brief impressions. So I saw this, I think, when I was about 10 years old. It really struck me at the time, and the thing that I do remember from it is the extremely sad ending with that robot tending the space garden all alone, seemingly forever. And I think I remember at the time it seemed completely unnecessary for that robot to be on its own, because the other robot, which was injured, could have been there as well. But anyway, that was an abiding memory from when I was 10 years old. Any thoughts about it before we get into it, Frank?
Yeah, I mean, I liked it. It's kind of a slower-paced movie, but it doesn't feel like it's boring, which proves they made a good film. It was one of the biggest inspirations for the American TV show Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Okay.
As one of the movies, he was inspired by to make the show. And so I wanted to see those influences. And I definitely see those influences in that show. I think this movie actually maybe influenced Star Wars a little bit too, because like a couple of the shots really look like something I'd seen in Star Wars before. I think when they're launching the pods off.
Yeah.
It looks like that one scene in A New Hope where they launch the escape pod at the beginning.
That's exactly what I thought, actually, Frank.
And R2-D2, of course, the drones.
R2-D2, I think, maybe very reminiscent. Inspired by these robots, too, So, overall, I thought it was a good movie. I watched it twice. I'd probably watch it again. I think there's some more messages and stuff in there, like if you watch it more closely, but you know, and I'm sure we'll unpack this in a bit. You know, there's definitely some message at the heart of the movie, So, pretty good.
Yeah, there are some things in there to unpack, for sure. Mark, general impressions?
Well, I think I probably might have seen it the same time as you on telly. I was probably about the same age, sort of BBC Two early evening.
Yes.
It was on, something like that. No, I loved it the first time I saw it. I think I've probably seen it four or five times, and then I saw it again the other night for this.
With the DVD that you successfully received.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you'll talk about that eventually. I'd forgotten, I suppose, that most of what happens at the beginning and the end, and the middle is not much happening, but in an interesting way, in the same as Dark Star, which is a John Carpenter film where there are three people, sort of a comedy sci-fi film that's essentially about just a day-to-day drudgery of space. 2001 is a lot of people aren't doing much in it, but if it's done in an interesting way, then I'm interested. So I felt there was more of this than I'd remembered, sort of just Bruce Dern and the robots. which is great fun, I think. And Bruce Dern is excellent, as we'll probably discuss later on.
We will, we will.
So I like it. Yeah, I like it. I mean, I have a few problems with it, the plot and some of the things that happened. I sort of watching it afresh and thinking that doesn't really add up, does it? But I still like it very much. I think it gets me on an emotional level. So I like that.
Yeah, that's true.
And I like being affected by something emotionally. I think that's good. Mm. So, yeah, I do. I do like it a lot.
Hmm. Okay, well, let's put people out of their misery. There are probably people thinking, well, I haven't even seen this film and I don't know what it's about. So here is a fairly brief plot summary. So it's set at some time in the future. We're not quite sure, but one commentator said there's a rumour that it's 2008. Okay, maybe. But I think that the fact that it doesn't say when it is a good thing, because I think if you actually specify up front like that, it can be a bit of a disappointment when you get past 2008 or whatever it is and you find that life isn't like that at all. Anyway, the first thing we see when the film opens up is a man called Freeman Lowell having a nude swim, which has cropped up in the last review we did with The Illustrated Man. There we go. So it's in the future, and somewhat implausibly, all plant life and presumably much animal life too on Earth is rapidly becoming extinct. So for some reason, as many species as possible have been loaded onto a bunch of huge dome-shaped forest greenhouses and sent into space, which is the kind of thing that one might immediately think of doing, attached to a huger spacecraft called Valley Forge, which itself is part of an even huger fleet of similar spacecraft floating around near Saturn for some reason, because that causes trouble, actually, in the film. And we have this chap called Freeman Lowell, who's had this nude swim. I have to keep getting that in. And he is one of four crew members on this spaceship. I suppose that's not quite true, because there are three other robot crew members, who we've already said are a bit like R2-D2 forerunners, who later on in the film get called Huey, Dewey, and Louie, who play a huge part in this film. Mm. Anyway, Lowell is the ship's botanist, stroke ecologist, stroke first aider, who diligently looks after all these plants and animals in the dome so that one day, and this is the nature of the mission itself, one day all these life forms can be returned to regreen and repopulate to the over-industrialized Earth. Now, after about 8 years, the crew receives a radio transmission ordering them to abandon their mission, nuke the forest domes for some reason, and return the spaceships to commercial service. And of course, Lowell is absolutely horrified by this. And so after four of the six domes are blown up, Lowell rebels and decides to save the remaining forests. And he kills one of the crew in a fight, and then he jettisons and detonates one of the last two remaining domes while his colleagues are in it setting up the bomb. So he is now left alone on the Valley Forge with the three robots and one forest. And to cut a long story short, the ship then ends up travelling dangerously through Saturn's rings, which causes one of the robots, Louie, to get ripped away by the ice particles, leaving behind just one limb. So he now continues the mission on his own terms and reprograms Huey and Dewey to plant trees and play poker with him to while away the hours. And Lowell sort of takes his eye off the ball because of all this, and the forest starts dying, much to his horror. He doesn't know why this is happening. Turns out to be lack of sunlight.
Who'd have thought?
I guess you might expect to be the case if you're orbiting Saturn for some strange reason. So he sets up a load of solar lights to restore the forest, but then he realises that his crimes are going to be discovered when another spaceship makes contact with him. So he decides to eject the remaining dome with Dewey on board, looking after it, while he and the now damaged Huey remain on the Valley Forge, which Lowell then blows up with a nuclear bomb. And thus we see finally the last dome lit up with solar cells floating off into deep space with Dewey on board holding an old watering can to look after this seemingly for eternity, accompanied by the evocative singing of Joan Baez as the credits start to roll. So there we are. Quite a detailed synopsis there. What do you think, chaps? Have I got any of that wrong?
Sounds right to me.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Okay, well, let's start with acting and the characters. Mm. I think the most obvious character to go for straight away is Freeman Lowell, played by Bruce Dern, who I think does it extremely well, actually. A very strange character to have to play.
Yeah.
I think he pulls it off really well. Any thoughts about Bruce Dern's performance?
Excellent. Weird, stoned, very quiet. He's sort of talking in a whisper a lot of the time, isn't he? Very intense. He doesn't do much, but you're focusing very much on his face.
Yes.
Understated, except when he's killing people.
I mean, that business about concentrating on his face, there's a, I think, a really good part of the film where he is burying or getting the robots to bury the dead colleague. And he says he wants to pray, but he can't pray. And he just has these faltering words. I've got them down here. I would like to be able to say a prayer, but I don't really know how to say it.
Yeah.
They weren't exactly my friends, but I did like them. And it goes on like that, with the camera just trained on his face. And I just thought that was really good to be able to deliver those lines whilst actually not looking into the camera, looking pained, and bringing that off somehow. That was very good.
I mean, why does he get the robots to bury him? Why doesn't he just do himself?
Well, he feels guilty, doesn't he, for sure?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a sort of physical distancing to help him feel emotionally distant from it. I don't know. It's an odd one.
No, I'm just wondering, just sort of wondered. And also, he gives the robots the dimensions, but doesn't tell them how deep.
You know,
no. This is 8 by 3 feet. Okay.
Well, they probably can't dig that deep anyway. They're pretty short robots. So.
Yeah. No, I like his character because it's there's a sort of psychotic edge to it. I mean, sometimes he's sort of a Jesus-like character or Francis of Assisi, perhaps more obviously with the birds and the rabbits coming to him. And at other times he can just go slightly berserk, lash out for what he thinks is the right reason. But, you know, it's sort of all means to the end, isn't it? It's sort of any means to an end.
Yeah.
So he's not a good man in a sense, is he? Because he's done some bad things. He's killed 3 people, you know, even though he's trying to keep this forest going.
In his mind, he's trying to keep all of the created order going, isn't it? Apart from human beings. In this situation, everything else is going to die off implausibly.
Yeah, and I think I hadn't, I mean, I'd watched it several times, but only the other day had I sort of realized, oh gosh, this is animals as well. You get the, you know, the forests and the plants, but it's full of animals. And of course, they're all killing off the animals. Does that mean there are no animals on Earth anymore? I do find that central idea a little bit fragile. Surely any planet that doesn't have any vegetation, I mean, that produces oxygen, does it not? So they're going to be in trouble, really, without any. And also, you say post-apocalyptic, but unless I've missed it, is there a reference to some kind of apocalypse or war or something that's happened?
Yeah, that's true.
I would actually maybe challenge the post-apocalyptic thing, because in one of the conversations, you know, the other crew members are telling Freeman that on Earth, everybody has a job. The climate is controlled. Nobody's hungry. Basically, they've sort of created a utopia. At least that's what I got out of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I suppose the apocalyptic thing is probably wrong, isn't it?
But it's very unfulfilling, you know?
Yes, yes. It's a sort of utopia that satisfies certain aspects of human life, but to the detriment of a fulfilled human life, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think Freeman talks about, you know, children are going to grow up and not even be able to see the beauty of a leaf in their hand. I mean, really extreme, of course, and unrealistic. But nevertheless, that's the end of any beauty, any aesthetics, any appreciation of the natural world. This extreme picture is presented, of course, in this very era here, the 1960s overlapping into the 1970s with the flowering of the environmental movement. You mentioned there St. Francis of Assisi, so I thought I would say something about this, because I think that's right. He's got this robe on, hasn't he, a sort of monk's habit, and he, as it opens up after he's had his nude swim, that is, I've got to get that in again. he talks to rabbits, doesn't he, and later on in the film he's talking to an owl. And I don't know if there's anything really in St. Francis of Assisi's writings that suggests that he did talk to animals, but nevertheless, that's the mythology that we've grown up with, isn't it? And there was a very famous lecture given by the also famous historian, Lynn White Jr. We've mentioned this on the show before, actually, and the lecture, which then became a very famous article. The lecture was given in 1966. It's called The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. And that gained a lot of attention, a cult status, really, environmental circles. And in that essay, he suggests St. Francis of Assisi as a sort of patron saint for the environmental movement. And I just thought, yeah, that's got to be a reflection of either the direct reference to that article, or it was very much in the air and got picked up on. So, yeah, I do see him as playing that part. But I also wonder whether He's also kind of an Adam figure as well, because he's there as a sort of priest figure almost in the garden, keeping and tilling the garden, as it says in Genesis. And also he's like the only true human, isn't he? You know, all these other humans, both there on the ship and back at home, have lost their humanity in this sense. They're detached from the natural world. So is he a sort of secularized version of Adam as well? The only true human, the real human? Perhaps we're getting too deep there, but...
No, I don't think you are. And I think that actually highlights something. There's no women in the film, is there? There's no Eve figure.
That's right. Do they even talk about girlfriends back home or wives back home?
Oh, I think they might do, perhaps.
I can't remember.
I don't think he does.
It may have been mentioned in passing. Mm. I remember something vaguely about that.
Although they've got they do have pictures up in their crew quarters of what presumably are family, I think, perhaps children.
Right, okay, yeah.
Thinking about it, so.
But it's quite fitting that he doesn't, that he would be monastic and totally committed to the cause.
Yeah, well, he's sort of masculine and feminine, isn't he? He's got feminine qualities, perhaps more than the other. I mean, the other ones, you know, are very masculine. They're driving their buggies around, and it's all very macho, and he's the opposite of that.
And they drive their, of course, unsubtly, they drive their buggies over the forest itself, don't they?
Yeah,
damaging the plants.
And they break one of those boxes, and there's an egg. Look, I think it's an ostrich egg. Is it an egg right at the beginning? There's an egg or something splats. Yeah. Or is it a fruit? I couldn't quite work out.
I think it was a fruit, maybe.
Okay.
Was it the melon? Because they criticize him for eating a melon, don't they?
Some sort of a melon, because later on he's eating some sort of melon or... Yes,
might be that then, yeah.
Yeah, so it's another one of those things where it's, you know, the other crew members, and I know it's all consistent with this idea that they're detached from nature, but they're all very happy to eat this, what is called synthetic food. It's a bit like Star Trek, isn't it? Getting things from the hole in the wall. Mm. And they're very satisfied with that. And Freeman is there, or Lowell, as he's called, is eating the melon, which is, to them, is all smelly and dirty. But I just thought it's a very sort of old science fiction idea, isn't it, that people will be satisfied by eating the pills or the synthetic food. I can't quite imagine people ever doing that, really.
Yes.
I remember growing up with the Jetsons, they'd have mealtime and then they just would pick what they wanted, and it's in a pill form, and they just eat that, and that's like they're satisfied.
Yes.
I just thought that was really weird. Yeah.
I mean, I suppose it's a sort of emotional premise. That's a warning. When you look at it, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm. But it's a warning about we must look after the planet. It's almost a satire because none of it actually scientifically makes a heck of a lot of sense. Mm. I remember at school, we studied a poem and it was about the last rabbit in the world? And we're visiting the last rabbit or something. And it sort of doesn't really make sense because, you know, there'd be more than one, wouldn't there? But it's just the idea that this careful that you might lose all this if you're not careful. Mm. Does that mean everyone, all the inhabitants of the earth, all those who are got full employment, they all eat artificial food? Presumably so, I'm guessing, because if they had animals, what would they feed the animals? It would all be intense farming, wouldn't it? Factory farming, I suppose.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I suppose it's all the artificial meat like Bill Gates is developing, that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe they're all eating Soylent Green.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Heavens.
That's good.
Yeah, that is good. Yeah. Yeah. There's a real sort of universe there.
Because it looks like it comes from the same universe. Yes.
It's a very, it reminded me of that universe a little bit. Yeah. Mm.
We just need Charlton Heston to crash in on the ceiling. Yeah. No, this must stop.
So, yeah, Soylent Green is people.
Yeah.
Where were we?
Yeah, well, so we were talking about the actors and the characters, really, at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I did wonder whether it's worth talking about those three colleagues briefly. I think I only recognised Ron Rifkin, who played Marty Barker, because he was in L.A. Confidential and The Negotiator. But I don't recognise the other two. Do you recognise the other two?
I've never seen them in anything.
No. Mm.
They all have a kind of a familiar face, but I can't say that I've actually seen movies with them in it that I can put a finger on.
Right.
They just have this very, I guess, screen presence. That's what I find a lot of movies today lack, is the actors just don't have a screen presence. Like, these guys are just common-looking people, but they have, like, screen presence.
Hmm. They weren't really given much to do other than just be...
That's true.
Yeah.
Fodder, if you like, for him. Just something for him to get cross about, to have an argument with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. The only one who seemed to have any character was the one called John, played by Cliff Potts. He's the one who sort of cares a little bit more. Mm-hmm. seems to be a little bit more friendly with Lowell, but in the end, he's the one that Lowell has the fight with and kills, isn't it?
Which is the one that he heals? Which is the one who hurts his hand and then Lowell bandages it up for him? It's not him, is it?
Not sure.
I mean, that's the trouble. I think this highlights the problem. Yes. They don't really come across as individuals, do they?
No.
Because the film's not really about them.
No, they kind of represent the people back home, don't they, in a way?
Yeah.
What about the drones, then? Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Excellent. Yeah, they are. They're played by bilateral amputees, apparently. So they're all upside down in reality.
Yeah, they're all actually amputees. I think they were all missing legs or something.
Yeah, I don't think they're upside down. I think they're just walking on their legs. And they've
they're walking on their arms. Hands. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Their hands are replacing the robot, like they're the robot's feet.
Yeah.
You can see behind the scenes photos of these actors. I looked them up the other day just to see how they did it, because I'm like, well, that's going to be a person in a suit, because it's super obvious that it's a person in a suit. I'm like, how did they get people to be that short? And I'm like, well, they had to use somebody who didn't have legs. And I'm like, well, that's really weird.
Yeah, I think it works really well because it breaks up the human form, doesn't it? So you can sort of guess how it's done, but it still looks suitably weird and slightly alien-ish.
Yeah. And I like, too, about the robots, how, like, you know, after he's killed all his compatriots, he, like, and this is what I was talking about earlier, they kind of showcase the human condition a little bit. It's like, Freeman, he's like missing that human connection, even though he is not necessarily friendly with these people. They were human connections that he could make. He misses that. So that's why he suddenly names the robots to replace that. I think even he realizes after a certain amount of time that it's just not the same, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's programmed them to play cards, and they sort of do, but not really in a convincing way, you know?
Yeah. And plants.
Plant the tree. And it's such a screw up.
I know. His expression is brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant moment.
I thought it was rather odd that they had a program. He was able to reprogram these robots to do a medical operation. They had files for that. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have any files to program them to plant a tree, considering they were actually a sort of botanical mission. I thought they behaved like children, didn't they? They had the kind of innocence of children. I thought they were a nice counterpoint to the flawed nature of humanity, which is clearly on show, both with these three guys, as it were, representing humanity back home, detached from nature, but also Lowell himself is quite a compromised figure morally. But the robots, they seem to be beyond reproach, didn't they? And they seem weirdly to have, again, quite implausibly, but you can do what you like in a movie, they seem to have emotions too, didn't they? Which one was, one of the robots was damaged and had to be operated upon,
it's how they held hands, didn't they? I think. Didn't they hold hands? They held legs or something, didn't they? One held out its hand to the other one.
Yes, that's right. You're right. And the other one wouldn't go away because Lowell says, oh, go and fetch me something. And he or she, I don't know, doesn't make, would not go away because they wanted to see what was going on with the operation. Yep. And I thought that made it even more painful at the end that one of them is just left on their own for eternity with a watering can, with, according to the universe of this movie, with deep feelings for the other robot, which was unnecessarily blown up with an atomic bomb. I mean,
I know.
Why not just leave the two robots together there tending the garden? Very strange.
Well, why doesn't he stay with them? I don't really understand that. Why doesn't he just go with them? Why does he blow himself up?
Well, perhaps that's because he can't live without human beings after all.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't live with what he's done, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. He can't live with what he's done, and he can't live without the other people, too. As flawed and as disagreeable as their positions are, he still misses that human connection.
And yet at the same time, he goes and murders the other robot's friend. Yes. Yeah.
At the ending there, where he's launching that thing out into deep space, you know, those sunlight bulbs, I mean, aren't really going to last forever, and the robot's power cells aren't going to last forever. So, I mean, it's going to be even more of a sad ending when you realize all that's going to wind down and die.
Yes, I didn't mean real eternity when I said that. I just meant a kind of notional eternity.
Yeah.
Yes, it occurred to me, even when I was watching it when I was 10 years old, that, yeah, surely all the power is going to disappear, and this is totally futile. Yeah. It's a completely nihilistic end, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of implies the death of everything, because back home, you know, if the forests are not returned, and there's, like you were saying, Mark, you know, there's no plant life, then what future does even the Earth have? So I thought it was totally nihilistic at the end, actually.
Yeah. And yet you've got this sort of music playing, Joan Baez playing, and the thing going off, and it's all sort of somehow poignant, sad, but also hopeful. Well, it's not really, is it?
No,
hopeful.
It isn't. No, quite ironic.
Because those big spaceships presumably power the pods, don't they? They power the heat and the light and etc. So, and also they eject the forest, they eject these things and blow them up. And I don't really know why they had to blow them up. Why use all these bombs? Just eject them and leave them floating in space.
I think the answer to that is that those bombs are emblems of technology gone wrong and gone mad back home. It's part of the criticism, isn't it, of scientific hubris, the atom bomb, you know.
Well, I can see why that, yes, in that sense, yes, but it doesn't make any sense narratively. I mean, I can it symbolises macho man just destroying what he doesn't understand, but it doesn't make any sense.
I was wondering why the ships even had bombs on them to begin with, because I mean, presumably these things were launched up 8 years before the start of the movie to presumably grow and cultivate and keep the forest going for Earth. And then, but why would you even put bombs on that thing? I mean, unless their whole plan all along was to blow these things up. But
well, but why would they? Why? Yeah. Why? Why did they have the forests on in the first place? Does that ever really tackled?
Well, why send them into space?
Yeah, I don't know. That wasn't really addressed, why they send them to space. It's very touched on very briefly in the very beginning and not very clearly. I think they just talk about how they had been launched into space with the forest 8 years previously to try to preserve the forests and plant life and animals of Earth just for, I guess, posterity is what I got out of it. But I don't think it was really explicit.
I mean, that sort of almost makes more sense if it was a sort of post-apocalyptic world, so they might have had an impending nuclear catastrophe and they did this to preserve things before the world, and then perhaps that war never happened and they were just left with these things floating around. That sort of might explain it, perhaps.
Perhaps there is a post-apocalyptic, you know, post-nuclear war thing that happened and these were sent up there to preserve stuff, and then after the fallout of the nuclear war, they actually were able to preserve life on Earth and make it better and make everything. Yeah. They were actually able to pull a utopia out of a post-apocalyptic nightmare. Mm. And then they found after 8 years of this, it's like, okay, these are up there, but hey, guess what? We actually did better than having the actual Earth here. So let's just get rid of this stuff, you know?
Yeah, we're doing the work of the script writers here, but we're sort of making sense of it that's rather fudged in the film.
Yeah, there are some holes in the logic in the movie that the writers didn't really address, but I think there's enough clues in how the characters act and some of the dialogue that you can pull that out, you know?
I think, as either one of you said earlier on, that it really doesn't make...
No.
It doesn't really matter that it doesn't make full sense. And I mean, I'm just thinking of, you know, does it really matter? Maybe we could just see it as a form of sanctuary. You know, if you want to escape to a position of safety in the ancient world, you might escape to a temple. You might escape to the monastery kind of thing. And there you've got the one who's looking after you, the monastic figure. So you have to get away in order to achieve that. So maybe it's just working on that level. Mm. Get away from the Earth because the Earth is being ruined. Don't explain it any more than that.
Yeah.
It's sort of a setup like a lot of really early science fiction tales from the pulp era. You know, it's like you have this really crazy futuristic or science fiction idea, and when you pick it apart, it really doesn't make sense. You know, those real early golden age of science fiction stories, they just had this idea, and then they follow the thought experiment of what this idea could result in, and then you get the ending, and then that's it. You know, maybe sort of like a lot of Twilight Zone episodes too. You watch it, and it's like just a concept in that episode. But in reality, the more you think about it, the less likely it would be to work. It's just kind of a thought experiment in video form, you know?
Mm. I mean, perhaps we're asking too much of a film to be analyzed quite so
I think we are.
Strongly. But in a way, the film is good because it allows you to formulate an idea that makes sense. A bit like 2001, it leaves a lot of gaps for you to fill in.
And it leaves gaps as it's going along, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A long time to think about things when those spaceships are just crawling along really, really slowly, and you've got Joan Baez singing a robot with a watering can or whatever. It has a great charm, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
no laser beams, no fights in space or anything like that. It's just,
no, it is very charming. Yeah, yeah. And what do you think of the model work, guys, the effects and the models generally?
It's difficult to judge, isn't it? Because we've seen so much that's impressive since.
Mm.
But considering this is really just the turn of the 70s, I mean, the only thing I've got to compare with is 2001, which I understand Douglas Trumbull was involved with.
Yeah.
So this is the director. Well, I thought it was good.
Yes, I think it's good. I don't think it's... They're clearly models. I mean, they clearly look like models. There's only a few shots, I think, perhaps where they don't, where the pods are coming off, are separating and popping out and all the stuff. The little sort of tiny sparkly bits are coming out. I think those are really effective. But I think the models themselves look a bit like models. I mean, impressive because they're obviously big models, but...
Do you think because he didn't have the budget, did he, in comparison with Kubrick?
Well, you look at Kubrick, who spent, 3 years on the effects, or the whole film, and this was... I was reading a review, and it said the effects took 7 months, and the bit going through Saturn's rings took a week to film, whereas the Stargate sequence in 2001 probably took a year, I would have thought, or more. Actually, they were collating footage over a longer period than that. So, yeah, budget and time, it's much faster-paced film, and it just looks cheaper. I mean, that Saturn... I don't know what you thought, but I thought that looked pretty bad going through Saturn's rings.
I thought so too. I didn't really understand why there was a wind as well, because my understanding is that it would just be lots of ice particles of different sizes, which would certainly explain why the robot gets knocked off. But it seemed like a wind and lots of lights, and I thought, well, that seemed to be a bit of a cheap repeat of what happened in 2001, really.
Maybe they're trying to simulate the ice particles orbiting around Saturn at high speeds, but it apparently didn't work. So
not really, no.
The model worked, reminded me of like those old 1960s TV shows like Land of the Giants or Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. It's like that level of model work. Maybe it comes off a little better because they're in space, but...
Technically, it's sort of depth of field, isn't it? And I think Kubrick did it with 2001 by having very long exposures for each frame of film, which meant that the whole model was in focus from end to end.
He also was able to probably get more time and more money from the studio because it was so successful.
Yeah. But if you're filming a model normally, you'd have a slight difference in focus between, you know, the front and the back, and that immediately your brain says, oh, that's a small object, because a big object, it's all in focus. So you have to sort of get over that. I still think they're very good models, but just the way they're shot could have been a bit better. But
we're asking a lot, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I mustn't give the wrong impression. We're not talking about Flash Gordon or anything like that, are we here?
Oh, no.
You don't see anything hanging from the ceiling. Or...
And we're comparing with 2001. Nothing really can compare with that, I don't think.
No.
Technically.
No, it's very good. Okay, so your understanding that it was set around Saturn simply because Douglas Trumbull wanted to do what he hadn't been able to do in 2001. They had technical difficulties with it and ended up being Jupiter instead. So he thought, well, you know, let's achieve that for this one. But apart from that, I couldn't understand there was any reason to be around Saturn.
No reason. And also, they don't ever mention the title of the film, do they? They don't say, we're going to be going silent running now. It seems an odd title, silent running. If you don't know what it is...
Is that like a submarine? I always thought this was a submarine movie. I'd heard the title Silent Running, and I'm like, oh, a submarine movie?
Yeah. If you take a step back, it seems an odd title for a film, because what he's doing essentially is like he releases those cases into space to make it look like the ship's been damaged, turns off communication, and hopes not to be discovered. But it's not like an old-fashioned submarine movie. It's not tense or anything like that. And it's a sort of small aspect of the film, which is an environmental warning. And so it's an odd title, I think.
Didn't you think there was some connection, possibly, with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring?
I don't know there is. I sort of... That's more about chemical pollutants and as a warning.
But it's a very iconic book of the era, isn't it?
It's
10 years before or so, kickstarting environmental concerns in a big way.
It kickstarts the environmental movement, and this is, a continuation of it. So in that sense, it's all part and parcel of the same thing, I think.
And I did find out, since you said that, that a very, very close friend of Rachel Carson was called Dorothy Freeman. How about that? Freeman Lowell.
So, and of course, Freeman, we haven't mentioned that, but of course becomes a free man. Freeman is rather obvious, isn't it? And Lowell as well, I think I looked at it. Does it mean wolf or something?
Oh.
But I mean, you could say that about anything, couldn't you, if you look into it? Wolf Cub. The name Lowell is Wolf Cub in French baby names. Okay. That is a piece of whatever.
Take that with a pinch of salt.
That's what I was trying to think.
Yeah, you're never quite sure whether these things are intended or not, but it's nice to explore them, isn't it?
I mean, Freeman is obvious, surely. That's not a coincidence, is it?
Yeah. And one thing we did miss, talking about these connections, is Huey, Dewey and Louie were cartoon characters, Walt Disney cartoon characters.
Yeah, they're Donald Duck's nephews.
Yes. Yes.
I would have personally named them Larry, Curly, and Moe, but that's just me.
I've got a copy of a magazine called Starburst, which I used to get when I was a child. This is 1979, and they quote Trumbull in it as a review of the film. Can I quote what he says?
Do.
So he's talking about the screenwriters. The screenwriters didn't get what I wanted. Much of what they produced was too violent, vicious, and unfeeling. I ended up rewriting 2/3 of the script myself, he says. And then he goes on to say, it isn't that I'm interested in science fiction. Rather, I'm interested in technology and the technical ways of making film. In high school, I was interested in architecture and art and used to read some science fiction, Heinlein and Bradbury, and so on, but never very much of it. In fact, he admits, I never had any ambition to be a director. I wanted to be an illustrator, which sort of perhaps it makes sense that the film is visually stunning, but it, plot-wise, perhaps not terribly rigorous.
Yes.
And I don't know how well he was a director of actors. I think it's the only film he's directed. It's his own sole directing credit. I'd like to know how good he was at actually directing the actors rather than the technical aspects of it. I mean, obviously, Bruce Dern is... gives a brilliant performance, but would he have given one anyway?
Yes, maybe.
I mean, he doesn't do a bad job at all. I think he directs it very well.
Roger Ebert introduces him as an intelligent, if not sensational, director, and acknowledges that he's one of the best science fiction special effects men.
Right.
So that seemed to be clearly what he was mostly interested in. He actually says it has deep space effects, every bit the equal of those of 2001. Not sure about that.
I'm not sure about that. Not quite that level.
No, let's agree to disagree on that one.
I thought it was a mistake with the pool table to have an actual robot playing pool with him, because, you know, there you've got a 1970s robot in something that's supposed to be 2008 or even beyond, really. Why not just have a fake robot and have it much more impressive than that? It's so clunky, wasn't it? Odd decision, that one.
I suppose it was perhaps advanced for its time, and that was considered enough, really.
yes, I suppose so.
And it's a budget. It's a budget. I mean, we haven't mentioned the fact that it was filmed in the aircraft carrier, Valley Forge, which is why they changed. It was other name, and they changed it to Valley Forge because they were filming on the Valley Forge. So all that stuff on the driving around is all in the inside the this air. It was due to be decommissioned, so it was due to be junked. So they presumably got it for a cheap price. But it were. I think that makes it grounds it in reality. I think if they tried to do that in a studio, it could have looked terribly naff. All those long corridor shots and things work really well.
Yeah. Do you think that sets the scene for future films like Alien? You know, we have all the rivets everywhere and girders and that sort of prosaic functional interiors, rather than sort of the gleaming white that you'd expect of a.
I think it does.
I would say.
It's a bit overlit, isn't it? I mean, Silent Running, it could have been a bit darker, I think, in places, because that would have been then the more alien film. But it's like most science fiction, all science fiction films of genre tend to build on what's gone before. So, yeah, I'm sure Ridley Scott would have seen this and been influenced by it. It's the opposite of 2001, and it's sort of dirty and run down. And I think I've read people have sort of compared Alien and Silent Running. It's a commercial freighter ship of some sort. People worried about their bonus, they want to get back to Earth, you know, and all that. And it's the sort of humdrum life of what it might be in space in the future. Yeah, they are quite similar, aren't they?
Yeah, I think this movie definitely clearly inspired that sort of aesthetic through later science fiction movies. This movie reminded me a little bit of the Disney movie Black Hole. There's some shots in like some parts of the ship where you have domes and stuff in the black hole.
I didn't know that.
And you can see space a little bit. It reminded me quite a lot of that.
That's really funny you should say that, because it was reminding me too, and I was thinking, is that a relevant comment? But yeah, now you've said it. And the robots, cutesy robots. I mean, these robots I don't think are overly cutesy at all. They're sort of, as you said, they're kind of like children. But that did start a trend for small, cutesy robots.
It definitely did, Bob and Vincent and Black Hole are definitely more cutesy than these. But
And the spaceship in Black Hole is very long and angular and full of geodesic sort of shapes. And I mean, that's a sort of glass spaceship in Black Hole, isn't it? But very similar.
Yeah.
I love the Black Hole. I think it's great. Really good film.
Yeah, I like that movie too. The beginning part didn't really age well, but I think the rest of the movie is actually pretty good too.
It's fun. It's great fun. And again, technically pretty impressive, even though none of it really makes sense. Anyway, sorry, it's going off the track.
Yeah. No, not at all.
I mean, we can't discuss it here on a podcast because it's got no nude swimming scene, unfortunately.
No, unfortunately not. No. Oh dear. what about the music? I didn't realise, and you discovered this as well, Mark, that this guy, Peter Shkreli, was the PDQ Bark man.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that.
The most music I remember is the Joan Baez, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but the sort of flower power hippie kind of music, which I love. Mm. I think it works so well.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
I don't really remember the general score of it other than that, to be honest, other than it was okay.
No, I agree with you. Yes, the incidental music I thought was unremarkable. I thought it all worked. Yeah. But none of it really... Well, actually, there was one part that did stick out for me, and that was when he sets those solar lights going. There's a sort of plinky-plonky modal sound going along with the lights coming on. I thought that was really effective. Okay. But apart from that, it was really the songs.
Yes.
Which again, modal, folky, 60s sort of sounding, very flower powery sounding. Yeah. The words, I mean, the words are just, I've got them here.
Yeah, go on.
So we've got, it's almost a self-parody really, but it's wonderful because it's so extreme. So the Rejoice in the Sun is fields of children running wild in the sun. Like a forest is your child growing wild in the sun, doomed in his innocence in the sun. Gather your children to your side in the sun. Tell them what they love will die. Tell them why in the sun. Tell them it's not too late for today, one by one. Tell them to harvest and rejoice in the sun. And then Silent Running. The song called Silent Running. Earth between my toes and a flower in my hair. That's what I was wearing when we lay among the ferns. Earth between my toes and a flower I will wear when he returns. Wind upon his face and my fingers in his hair. Blah, 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 blah. It goes on like that. but it works extremely well, doesn't it? And it gets you.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely gets you.
Oh, I think so. It's poetry, isn't it?
Mm.
No, I think it's brilliant. I think it counterpoints the sort of technical side of it. And I mean, it's really hard to imagine what it would have been like in the 60s, 70s with the Vietnam War going on and the make love, not war, etc. I mean, I haven't really got sort of an inkling of what that would have been like to be there at the time. And this film sort of reflects that, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it does.
It's easy to be cynical, I suppose, but to sort of...
There's an inner hippie with me. I've said this on the program before, that part of me does actually... You know, I am attracted to that sort of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's another odd thing that he kills off two of the people by destroying the whole forest as well? Because he kills the first person, he fights him, the other two people, I think he sets the forest, he launches it with the two people inside and blows it up, but he's also destroyed the forest as well. Seems a little bit counterintuitive.
Yeah, I suppose he sees it as an opportunity to get rid of them.
Mm.
I don't know. I think we should talk about some of the philosophy of this, some of the dilemmas, ethical, moral dilemmas, etc.
Yep.
I mean, the big question I think that comes out is, was he right to kill these people to save the forest? I mean, that is an ethical question that's posed by the film, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's tricky, isn't it?
It's incredibly tricky.
I mean, what's interesting is at the beginning of the film, he says, they're going to make me park supervisor or parks and recreation supervisor.
Mm.
So you think, well, hang on, is it actually his ego? He just wants to supervise these things. You know, there is a sort of element of self-justification.
I never thought of that. Dr. Dwayne Day wrote a review about this. He brings this up. Let me quote this. He says, the film raises a point that it never really answers, was it right to kill three humans to save the last remaining forest? And this is where the film dips its toe into the deep end and exhibits greater sophistication than many critics give it credit for. It is easy to dismiss Silent Running as a weepy eco-propaganda film about a sensitive tree-hugging hippie who is dedicated to saving the forests. And then he goes on, but Dern does not play the character of Freeman Lowell as a hero. We're not supposed to like him. So, yeah, it is a question that is posed. We really do have to get an answer here, chaps.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I think he's wrong in killing people. I would put people above plants
absolutely,
and animals.
Yeah.
But there are millions more people down on Earth, and this is the last of the rabbits. Come on.
Because these people want to kill off the whole of the natural world, apart from humans. This is all that's left, isn't it? And symbolically.
I think this is all that's left. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it is literally, what's the greater good here? But then those people had families back on Earth, and, you know, they're human beings. That's the other thing. He could have tried to persuade them. He doesn't really do that, does he? There's no kind of... I suppose they're unpersuadable. I suppose that's what you're supposed to believe. But he does get physical quite quickly, doesn't he, really? But yeah. That's what I like about the character. It's a complicated character.
Yeah.
You're sort of siding with his viewpoint and his passion, but then you're perhaps not siding with what he actually does about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
You see, my initial inclination when I see something like this is to think, well, it's being eco-extremist, and it's saying plants and animals are of equal value to human beings, and when you know, you weigh those in the balance, and, well, I'm afraid the human beings have to go because these plants and animals are extremely important. I'm not so sure about that, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it's that simple. I'm not sure it's that extreme.
I think
one of the ways I make sense of this, I don't know whether you agree with it, I don't think I hinted at this earlier, is that because this forest represents the whole of nature, apart from human beings, as it were, the entailment of destroying the whole of nature is probably going to be to destroy all of humanity anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because how could humanity continue to exist without any other natural world? But I don't know. I may be going too far with that. But I don't think it's as simple to say that it's just an eco-extremist film. I don't think it is.
I don't know that he's justified to do it because, like, this is not to say that, like, the end justifies the means. But, like, you could have a little more of an argument that he was justified in killing those guys. Like, if he had actually saved all of the forest or even had competently saved even one of the forest. But then when you like view the end result of this thing going into deep space and probably potentially dying eventually anyways, the end result is now he's killed three people and he still hasn't saved the forest in the long term.
Yeah.
True.
We don't know how
but that's out. What we see at the end. I mean, he doesn't know how it's going to turn out, does he? Sorry, what did you say, Frank?
I was going to say perhaps somebody recovers it and reconsiders, but it sounds to me like they're already decided that they don't want forests anymore. And so even if somebody finds it, I mean, nobody's going to care enough to save it.
Yeah.
To say, again, that the end would justify the means, but if he had actually somehow scored some sort of victory and somehow actually preserved this forest for all time, set up a sanctuary, then perhaps maybe you could make an argument he was justified, but I would say that.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I think this goes back to the same problem we had earlier, that when you try to make sense of the narrative, then you get into trouble. I think we've just got to, it's weird, isn't it? Because you have to sort of look at it at face value, but then say, what is it saying? Mm. And not go too far with trying to make sense of the narrative. It is a bit tricky, actually.
I mean, thinking while you were talking, I was sort of thinking you could, I mean, I know that I'm sort of rewriting the script, but you could have had a situation where, say, he takes the others hostage and contacts Anderson, who's the boss, isn't he? Says, look, these three I've got hostage, I'm going to kill them unless you ask me to contact somebody on Earth and say, look, let's have a vote. Do we want these back? You know, he could have tried to communicate with people back on Earth instead of just going on his own. And then he could have got a bit of tension, a bit of drama that way. But then that would have been a different film, obviously. But that might have given a little bit of a more intellectual argument to he could have communicated. He doesn't really, he's a very insular person, his character. He acts on a whim almost, and then has to deal with the consequences of the guilt and stuff. It's interesting when you say, did he do the right thing? As a child, when I watched it, I thought, absolutely, he's done the right thing. And then as an adult, I watch it and think, no, I don't think so. You know, it's more complicated than that. So I think, so it's two answers to the same question.
Yeah.
I think depending how old you are, for a child, you go, oh, yes, of course, because you don't really think about death. And then as you get older, wait a minute, you know, let's think about this a bit better. And as you say at the end, I know he doesn't know that's going to turn out, but it's all a bit pointless at the end.
Yes, and I think as a child, I didn't understand the sort of theological dimension of it either.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings made in God's image, etc., I wouldn't have seen that as an argument, but of course I do now. So that very much is part of the equation there. But of course, then there is always the argument, you know, with the just war and that sort of thing. And, you know, do you defend somebody against a murderer? You know, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Self-defense, of course, is another thing that comes out of this. So it's not a simple answer, but obviously
it's the old Star Trek.
The importance of human life.
Yeah. It's the Star Trek 2 dilemma, isn't it? The Wrath of Khan dilemma. The good of the many outweighs the good of the one, which they play around with, don't they?
I'm afraid I forgot that one.
Well, you know, when Spock sort of kills himself to save the Enterprise, and he says to Jim, you know, the good of the many outweighs the good of the one, and he sort of dies to save everyone else.
Yes.
And William Shatner said, no, the good of the one outweighs the good of the many, because his friend, he doesn't want him to die. Yeah. But you can't, it's just that you can't really weigh up. It's very hard to make these decisions, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it would have been more interesting if the other people had been more friendly and less cliched macho characters. I mean,
Yeah.
That would have been a more interesting story, but they are very obviously rather stupid and unthinking, and it's therefore more easy for him to get, I suppose. Seems that way.
Seems like they were already bought into the system pretty well. They thought the world system, everybody having a job, because they had that argument many times before, it sounds like. They were pretty entrenched in the world system, whereas Bruce Byrne was like, no, this is not good for humanity.
He's an outsider, isn't he? He's an underdog. And you kind of wonder what he's doing there at all, actually. Because he doesn't really seem right material for that isolated spaceship thing for years and years.
It's probably a situation where his knowledge and experience of caring for plants and stuff was probably what got him on there. Certainly it wasn't his adherence to party policy.
Mm.
So what do you think of the worldview aspect of the film? You know, we talked about this eco-extremism, and I'm not quite sure that it really is. But one thing that came over to me was the duality, the dualism of, you know, on the one hand, technology, progress, perhaps even mind being bad. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, the natural world and feelings are good. Quite a simplistic duality there that was set up, which was very much of its time.
Mm.
You know, that goes together with, you know, the feelings, the simplicity, the childlikeness of the robots, the natural world. He's the spiritual one as well.
Mm.
So, you know, drones, Lowell, Earth, as it was natural with plants, and as it will be in the future, hopefully we'll be back with plants again. But it's ruined at the moment because we've got mind in control, technology, it's an adult world detached from nature, not a childlike world. You know, it's materialistic, and his colleagues represent that Earth as it is. So it's very dualistic in that sense.
There's not much to say, because I think it's done so much as a modern fairy tale, isn't it? As an ecological warning.
Yes.
And it is very black and white. I mean, Bruce Dern's character is sort of shades of grey, if you like, but the film is a fairy tale.
Mm.
And one shouldn't really look too deep into fairy tales, how they work, because they often don't make a lot of sense, but they're making a point.
Yes. Yes.
Perhaps this movie, maybe I'm giving it too much credit for its message and maybe doing too much work for the scriptwriters again, but perhaps you have this movie and you see these two worldviews, one, the super environmental view of Freeman, and you also then have the go along to get along worldview of the other guys, his crew members, and then basically everyone else on Earth. And I think how I see it as it's presented is, both of those worldviews are flawed in some way.
Mm.
Obviously, the technocratic view, we don't need nature anymore, is obviously flawed for the various reasons you've addressed on your show. But you also get to look at Freeman's worldview, and while his worldview does have some redeeming qualities, you see his worldview is a little bit too extreme, and still is just as bad for humanity and human beings as that of the technocratic one. Obviously, because it led to three people dying and then he killed himself. So perhaps maybe the movie is, or perhaps what our takeaway from the movie in looking at the worldview should be that, okay, both of these are wrong. Perhaps there's some way to take the good from each thing and come up with a more balanced worldview. I guess what they would call the Hegelian dialectic. You have the two opposing viewpoints and you go to a consensus in the middle and come up with something. I'm going to look at this optimistically and say maybe we should come away from this movie with a worldview that's slightly more optimistic.
Yes.
Where we, take care of nature, but we also need to take care not to elevate nature above the value and welfare and well-being of human beings as well.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very rarely hear anybody present an Hegelian structure in a positive light there, Frank, but but why not? I mean, on a very straightforward, taking the good from both points. Yes, I think that makes sense in this instance, doesn't it?
Mm. I thought that at the end of the film, it makes me think the whole thing is very Spielbergian.
Hmm.
Especially the last shot of the forest slowly moving away with the music under it. It's exactly the same as the end of Close Encounters of the Kind, where the big spaceship moves away and you've got When You Wish Upon a Star playing as it moves away.
Yes.
And Spielberg in Close Encounters and in a lot of his films has the central character is perhaps a slightly dysfunctioning man who's in touch with his feelings against a very officialdom, an unthinking, the hard-nosed officialdom, especially in Close Encounters where he's up against the military who are in charge, and he has feelings and empathy and stuff, and this is exactly what Bruce Dern is feeling. and you're always being asked to side for this person, the lone individual, the lone wolf, if you like. And so I did feel that's very Spielbergian, this thing of feeling over brain, heart over head, if that makes sense.
Yes, but I suppose we'd be saying that Spielberg is getting an influence there from this film.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting about the technocratic thing that you brought up, Frank. Obviously, this comes up a lot in the show.
Yeah.
But what a sort of old-fashioned technocratic view. It doesn't fit with the way technocracy seems to have developed, which, of course, is to become unified with the notion of sustainable development now, to sort of exploit the environmentalist scene. So actually, a technocratic worldview now would look a lot different from how it would have looked back in those days. I mean, I'm not here saying that, therefore, a modern sustainable development technocratic worldview is a great thing. I think it has its own horrendous problems. But nevertheless, I think it would have been a different flavour back then.
Yeah, I think so too.
Mm.
I just think the government officials in this movie were basically deciding what's best for humanity and making all the scientific and, you know, basically making every temperature the same, making everybody have a job, and trying to present its version of utopia to humanity. And clearly, it's not something that everyone buys into, given, you know, you have a minority of people like Freeman probably who don't like this system that's been imposed on them. As benign as it's supposed to seem, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I wasn't disagreeing with you. I just thought it would have a different flavor now. Decades have gone on, so technocracy is looking different. But it's basically the same kind of thing, isn't it? With experts saying how the world should run and all that sort of thing, and an end of democracy and blah, blah, blah.
I mean, could they make this film today?
Ooh.
There'd be a lot of different issues to deal with for sure.
I'm just trying to think if anybody has made anything like that film in today's climate.
I suppose now you'd have to have a world that did have a lot of the natural world still left, but human beings not being able to trample upon much of it and all put into smart cities. And then you'd have to have greenhouses with little businesses and small democracies on going out into space.
Like that. Doesn't sound so exciting.
No, and freedom of speech and things like that.
Yeah, I don't think anything else really tackles these same issues, because although we still have some environmentalism with climate change and stuff, you don't really see that really as a point in movies anymore. Bringing this up, you know, in the 60s you have all these environmental movies that were tackling or dealing with the environmental issues of the day. Like, I remember, wasn't it in the 60s, overpopulation was kind of a buzz. Mm-hmm. Then you get movies like Soylent Green. Now it's, and Mark may be able to speak more about this, but it seems like cinema now, a lot of it is just rebooting and remaking old movies and not making anything new or even dealing with issues in society necessarily.
No, I think people are scared now. Filmmakers are scared. I mean, Silent Running was essentially just Doug Trumbull. It was an independent film, essentially, taken up by Universal. But now, films tend to be done by committee, and artistic integrity is probably quite low down on the list. And they don't want to alienate their audience. Cinema is much more now than it ever been about making money. And the whole COVID, reopening cinemas and the COVID pandemic, I don't think it's about health risking people's lives. It's about waiting till all the cinemas are open before they release their big films. And it's about waiting for places like America to reopen. They want to make the money, the most money from the film. It's not about people's health.
Yeah.
And as you say, reboots, remaking films, franchising films, having prequels to famous films. The artistic integrity and creativity is way down the list. And a film like this, I just think, would alienate too many people and wouldn't be made.
I agree, yeah. They want to make it safe to distribute in China, too, where obviously there's a huge market of people.
That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, they want China to be open, and of course it's not ready yet, so they're having to wait to all these films. Oh, we're doing it because we don't want to risk you coming to the cinema. No, it's nothing to do with that. It's nothing to do with that at all. And they don't want to really release films in different territories at different times because the piracy will become rife.
Oh, yeah.
that's the thing. Nowadays, the film has to come out everywhere at the same time.
Yeah.
It's a business. It's a money-making business, much more than it ever used to be, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Which is a shame. So you have to seek out those films, and there are some brilliant films out there, but you have to sort of seek them out, not the mainstream films. If they made a film like this now, it would be so full of effects. Terrible.
Yeah, to go off on this tangent just another moment, if you want to see movies like, not exactly like this, but like more modern movies that are similar to this in that they have good acting and tight focus on smaller amounts of characters that deal with like technology and humanity together. One movie I saw years ago was called Robot and Frank.
Oh, yes, I saw that. Yeah, no, it's good.
Yeah. No relation to me, of course, but but it was a movie that dealt with how technology and humanity will interact. This guy, he's got like memory or dementia. He's got some sort of issues with his memory and health and stuff, and so his kids are like too busy to help out their dad, so they get him a personal care robot to help him to take care of himself. And he ends up teaching, because he's a retired like cat burglar, he teaches the robot how to become a cat burglar. It's a very small budget independent movie, but you
Frank
get
Langella, it, isn't it? Frank Langella?
Yeah, Frank Langella. It's a great movie, well acted, great cast. Susan Sarandon's in it, I think. The guy who played Cyclops from X-Men's in it, James Marsden, and I think Liv Tyler's in it too.
Okay. Oh, good.
Yeah. Pretty big names for an independent movie, but
any nude swimming in it?
No, there's no nude swimming, but maybe there's like a shower scene or something. I don't know.
Oh, that'll do.
I remember for sure. It's been a while.
No, but apart from that, it does sound very interesting film.
Ex Machina is another one. It had Oscar Isaac in it. That's another one that deals with. So to get a movie like Silent Running now, you have to go to these small independent projects, and then you're getting these movies like Ex Machina and Robot and Frank that deal with the human condition coming up against in dealing with technology.
Do you know, there's an interesting parallel there with the pandemic itself. When we talked just a minute ago about the pandemic, where do you go to get treatments for what's going on? You go to independent doctors who are actually trying to find treatments, but the system doesn't seem to be all that interested. It seems to be interested in making money and having control and suppressing possible treatments like, you know, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, etc. It's a strange world we're living in, a world of money making and control.
It is, absolutely.
I think it's always been us, but it's just getting rather more obvious as we get older, isn't it?
It is. It's getting worse and getting obvious. Yes, indeed. Well, I want to give the last word to Roger Ebert, because I think there was a good paragraph here that he wrote about this. So let me quote this. Quote, Silent Running isn't, in the last analysis, a very profound movie, nor does it try to be. If it had, it could have been a pretentious disaster. It is about a basically uncomplicated man faced with an awesome but uncomplicated situation, given a choice between the lives of his companions and the lives of Earth's last surviving firs and pines, oaks and elms and creepers and cantaloupes. He decides for the growing things. After all, there are plenty of men. His problem is that after a while, he begins to miss them. Oh, that was quite a good summing up of the movie, actually.
Yeah, but I don't think he's uncomplicated. I think he's complicated.
Yes, you're right.
No, I mean, that's right. But otherwise, I just think, that's what makes it interesting. He's a complicated character.
Yeah, he is. But the way he presents himself seems kind of uncomplicated, doesn't it? But you're right.
Yeah.
As soon as you start thinking about him.
Well, also, if he was truly uncomplicated, I don't think he would have any regrets for what he does. But he's, you know, he does, and that's what makes him interesting and complex. So.
Okay, well, so, thanks. Yeah.
No, sorry.
I was just going to say thanks ever so much, both of you, for coming on to talk about this one. Strange film. It's a film that I love. I always have loved it since I first saw it when I was 10 years old. I enjoyed seeing it again recently. And I think it's one of those films that I will continue periodically to look at and just really enjoy it because of the atmosphere and the way it makes me feel. The mixture of the music and the silence and those scenes of the spaceship's rolling along with the robot with the watering can in its hand, and I just want to cry. But also some of the themes that it brings up, which seem so dated, but on the other hand, I think they do still say something. You know, we don't want a world that is polluted. We don't want a world that is industrialized to the point of destruction. We do want a world where we are looking after the natural world, but also respecting human life as well. So there are lots of major themes in there to continue thinking about and benefiting from. So I love the film. So anyway, thanks, you two, for coming on to discuss yet another film, number 5 in this series. So you mentioned Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That's something on the list for sure. So hopefully we'll do that in due course.
Cool. Brilliant.
Great to speak to you two again.
Very good. Thanks, Julian.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Julian.